have you done?
I feel completely electricity.
And this sort of daydream came to me that
it was in my blood.
Is there anything worse
what are you doing?
Than someone saying, oh, no. I thought about that a lot afterwards.
He says, I'm not leaving.
It's weird.
I'm staying.
And then by the light of an oil lamp.
Conversations with Sarah Kanofsky on ABC Radio.
Yes, Sarah Kanofsky filling in for Richard Feidler as he's off on his adventure in Iceland. My guest today is Mike Lanza. Now, when Mike Lanza was growing up, he and his friends felt like they owned their neighbourhood. They played outside till dark. They played on the road, for goodness sake. They built tree houses. They shared backyards like there were no fences between them. Mike might have been part of the last generation of kids who were allowed to roam freely. As an adult, he worked in Silicon Valley as a software developer and made his money building startups. Now Mike Lanza has a family, three boys, that's busy, and he and his wife have very deliberately set out to give his kids something like Mike's own childhood. And Mike Lanza has written a kind of manual about how to do this. It's called Playbohood. Turn your neighbourhood into a place for play. Welcome to Conversations, Mike.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Whereabouts did you grow up?
I grew up outside Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, in the United States, and wasn't anything really remarkable. I had a childhood like many other people, but now looking in retrospect, I noticed that it's very unique for kids today to have the kind of childhood I had where we were so free to roam around.
So what was a typical day in the life of a seven-year-old Mike Lanza?
At seven, I was definitely allowed to go out on my own and to roam the neighborhood with my friends. And we had two hangouts, and hangouts is a very important theme that I talk about a lot for kids. They like to go to a place where they can just be with other kids that they know on a regular basis. And one was a patch of street between my house and a neighbor's house where we played all sorts of sports, American football or softball, hockey. Or we also had a treehouse in the woods. And we would go out, come home for lunch, and then go out again and come home at dinner.
And who was in your gang?
I'm a boy, and we had lots of boys. Sometimes girls played with us when we played tag, hide and go seek.
When you needed someone to torture, in my experience.
There were about, you know, a core group of maybe six, seven boys, and then other kids. Some girls would join in different things. We just had a wonderful time. We didn't need summer camps. We didn't need programmed activities, and we didn't need video games.
So when you were hanging out, what sort of stuff were you actually doing?
Well, it's funny. I mean, our memories, you know, kind of always go to the nice things, the fun things that we did. We had played a lot of great sports. We built a treehouse and hung out there. But there was also a lot of empty time, which I think is important to talk about as well. You're never going to click all the time. And I think the kids today have so many different things competing for their attention that if they have any empty time going outside, they're going to run right back in because they can turn on that video game right away, and they just reject that empty time, unlike us years ago when we didn't have anything else to do.
Do you remember being bored as a kid?
Sure, I remember being bored. I remember times going out, seeing my friends and standing around for a half hour, an hour, and saying, "What are we going to do? I don't know. What should we do? Our wheels were spinning. We couldn't figure out what was going on. But then finally, we'd find something. And it was rewarding, really, to find things on our own and to kind of manage our own time, to kind of create our own world without having adults tell us what to do.
And so you talk about there being hangout spots that you went to. What other landmarks do you remember being important in your childhood world?
Well, for instance, there was, like I said, a patch of street between my house and a neighbor's house. And we spray painted markings on, for instance, we played softball, kind of like baseball, and we spray painted bases on the road. We also spray painted lines on the road to play American football. That was really our place. And funny, when cars would come by, we did not run out of the way immediately. We would stare the cars down. We would walk. We would walk off the road really slowly, and we had a chant that we would kind of yell at the cars, because we were not willing to accept the idea that that streets are only for cars. They were. It was for us too. One time, we actually put up.
What was your chant?
Car, C-A-R, put your head in a jelly jar. And we would just say that over and over again. One time I remember one time we put up some barriers on the street and put up a sign asking for a toll, because, you know, we figured if they're going to drive down our street, we should get some money out of it.
Excellent entrepreneurial flair.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But to be serious for a moment, it's the case that now most people just assume that all streets are only exclusively for cars. And in my neighborhood today, I don't accept that, and my kids don't accept that.
But is there a case that there would have been a lot fewer cars when you were growing up? I mean, how much traffic was there?
There wasn't a lot of traffic on our street, but I think that even on streets with less traffic, most adults just surrender. They just presume that it's not the right of pedestrians, bicyclists to be on that street. And I don't accept that. And we try to, you know, we claim that street just like cars do.
And what about the dynamic between you and your gang, Mike? I mean, were there times when fights broke out?
Oh, absolutely. One of the most important lessons that you learn as a kid, when you don't have adults managing all of your activities, is that you have to modulate your behavior so that people still want to play with you the next time you go out. So you have to figure out how to settle things. You have to control your temper. You have to figure out what the rules are, and if the rules don't cover what just happened, you have to figure out, okay, how are we going to settle this problem? It's kind of like the things that people have to do in adult life, and kids who learn that every day become, I think, better adults, better at managing their world.
But do kids need help from adults in learning those skills?
Sure. We all grow up with parents around. Parents are very, very important. But I think the pendulum has swung too far. I think that parents are too involved. Certainly, kids sleep in their house. They have meals with their parents. They learn incredible life lessons with their parents. But then they need to go out and try things on their own a little bit, or else their growth their development is stunted.
What about hurting yourself physically in this sort of free-range childhood? What kind of scrapes did you come away with, or your family?
I had bruises on my legs all the time. There was always one or two black and blues, always a couple cuts and scrapes. That's normal. And, I have three boys, so and I have this philosophy. So, you know, when I see my kid yell and scream and get hurt, if I don't see any blood spewing out, usually I feel like, okay, they're going to be okay. And, just take it easy, guys.
Tree houses are great for scrapes and bruises and various broken limbs. Tell me about what your treehouse looked like.
It was, I was much shorter when we built that treehouse, and it seemed to me at the time like it was a skyscraper. It was way up in the trees. It was probably about 8 or 10 feet high off the ground. And it had two levels. It was probably not very safe. I can recall it being kind of not level and wondering about how some boards were attached to one of the trees. Because we managed it ourselves, we were able to really think through for ourselves how to make this the best treehouse we could. And we took that responsibility and we succeeded. We made a treehouse that worked for us. And a lot like what my kids do today, we don't try to manage everything that they do. And they do a lot of risky things, but they learn how to take risks. I think that's an important part of childhood.
And who built it?
We did.
Yeah.
We did. And the older kids, interesting thing, a lot of people tell parents they should play with their kids. It's a big mantra that we hear a lot. Parents should, be playful, go out, play with their kids. But in our neighborhood, it worked the way I think it should work more. Yes, parents sometimes, but for the most part, it was older kids taking the lead and showing younger kids how to do things. So there were a group of kids about 3 years older than me, my sister's age, and they really took the lead. They were the ones who knew how to do more cutting wood and nailing things in, and I learned from them.
I'm interested in your parents, Mike. I mean, what was their attitude to how you and your friends filled your time?
I think most parents don't want to rock the boat, and so they do what they see other parents doing.
But what about your
parents? And my parents were no different from the other parents that I knew. My mother had an impulse to be overprotective, but she accepted the norms that we had in our neighborhood to let kids go out. I remember one time when I was 3 years old, other three-year-olds were allowed to, and I just turned four. Other parents were letting their kids at my age go off their property without the parents around.
At four.
And so my mother did. And a boy who 3 years older than me lived across the street, took me down into the woods, and nothing horrible, but somehow my clothes ended up in the tree with him, and he left me in a dirt pit, and I was gone for a couple hours, and the neighborhood panicked, and everybody ran around looking to find me, and finally a girl in the neighborhood found me. My parents were upset, but they told me, they just kind of gave me some guidelines about how to deal with a situation like that, and I was out the next day.
And so what do you remember of that experience? So was it terrifying?
It was memorable. I wouldn't say terrifying. It was strange to be in a dirt pit in my clothes up in the tree with this boy. I definitely remember that. And I remember the girl coming to find me, and I mostly appreciate the fact that my parents chalked it up to, learning a good lesson, and I was out the next day. I didn't want to sacrifice. I wouldn't have wanted to sacrifice the freedom, the wonderful play life that we had in the neighborhood because a kid did something stupid.
Yeah. Do you remember when you say your parents gave you strategies to deal with something like that, do you remember what they told you about how to handle finding yourself in a situation that was uncomfortable, maybe dangerous?
I think they just told me, think about what's happening. Don't just blindly accept what someone tells you to do. They never said, and this boy who's in the neighborhood, he wasn't a stranger, but they never told me don't talk to strangers. I happen to think that's not a very good recommendation to give kids. I think most strangers are nice people, but there are cues that we can see in certain people that maybe make us shy away from them. They told me just to kind of be aware, to really take in the situation, to understand what's going on, and to not just blindly follow people.
You live to play another day.
Absolutely.
What about school, Mike? Was the sort of play that happened at school when you were a kid in contrast to this very free play that happened at home?
No, school was very similar. First of all, we all walked to school to and from.
Now, where you grew up in Pittsburgh, did you?
The suburbs of Pittsburgh.
It gets cold in winter in Pittsburgh.
Absolutely, snow. We had to walk through snow, and we walked every day from first grade. My mother drove me to kindergarten, but first grade when I was 6 years old, we were walking to school. And then we had recess, and we played pretty freely at recess as well. Kids got into fights. There aren't too many fights in school these days. Fights can be bad. Kids can get really hurt, and I don't really advocate fighting. But we learned a lot of lessons in recess as well as after school.
Yeah. And what was the payoff of walking to school, do you think, even through snow?
Oh, I'm a huge advocate of walking or biking to school. All my three kids biked every day to school. I think it's, first of all, it gets you going, gets your blood flowing in the morning when you get out of bed, rather than being driven. Also, you have to take some responsibility. You have to get your body moving. You have to get things in your bag. You have to get there yourself. It's very social. You get to see other people who go to school with you on the way home. You don't have to be home at any certain hour. At least I didn't. And so sometimes you stop off and see other kids and play. And I think it's just it makes for a wonderful life for kids if they walk to school and they can play with their friends after school.
I guess they've got a lot more. They've got a lot more ownership of their time if they're doing, if they're in charge of getting themselves to
exactly, absolutely. They're making decisions, and they're choosing who to be with and what to do. And I think one of the chief problems of children today is that they don't make their own decisions very often. And so they don't really understand how to manage their own lives, how to motivate, how to be motivated intrinsically from within to do what they want to do, as opposed to being motivated extrinsically by rules forced upon them by others.
Did you have a part-time job when you were a kid?
I did. I worked for my father ran a pharmacy and also sold medical supplies, and I worked for my dad starting at 9 years old. I made 25 cents an hour, which was
princely sum.
Yeah, which was small even then. But as I like to tell my oldest son, who's now 10 years old, I was probably worth negative 25 cents an hour. I was a very bad employee, but I learned. I learned how to work, and I very much value, that's another thing that I harp on quite a bit. I value work for children, making a wage, and the responsibility that comes with that, and also earning real money and managing your own money, I think is very important as well.
What did you spend your 25 cents an hour on?
You're asking good questions. I was a big baseball fan, as I am today, and my dad at his pharmacy sold baseball cards. And the first two times I earned that $2 for 8 hours of work, I bought a box of baseball cards. So I blew the whole thing on a box of baseball cards. And I learned after a few times that that was a pretty dumb way to spend my money. But it's a learning experience.
Mike, I wonder, you know, it sounds, well, I wonder if your father had a similar sort of childhood. I mean, the way you're talking about it, it's a childhood of your age, but it sounds like it could have almost described your parents' generation as well, do you think?
Well, I suppose you could say that the childhood of today is more different than my childhood, than my childhood is to my father's. So I think they were more similar. But my father's childhood, they had no television. They had fewer activities possible. And my dad grew up in a poor neighborhood in Pittsburgh, and they were more resourceful than we were. He tells me stories of how they would go to different places where garbage was dumped and put things together and nail them together and make something that they would play with for weeks. I'm sure there were down times, but it sounds idyllic to me. They were very resourceful, and I really appreciate that.
Was there anything that you would change, if you could, about the way you were brought up?
I was very happy as a kid. I think that everybody goes through, you know, some negative experiences in their lives and in their childhood. You know, it would have been nice. I guess I regretted not having more siblings. I had one sibling, an older sister, who didn't really go out and have fun. She was not a very happy-go-lucky kid. I used to watch TV shows in America. There's a TV show called The Brady Bunch. You may have seen
it. We know it.
You know about The Brady Bunch. And I thought, boy, it'd be great to have six kids in my family.
And Alice. I look at it now and I think, God, it'd be great to have an Alice.
Yeah, absolutely.
Get the siblings.
This may seem weird, I was jealous of the three boys sharing one room. I thought that was great, sleeping in bunk beds and being able to chat when you went to sleep. For me, it's always been an ideal to have lots of kids around and to play a lot. And I think most kids, they like that.
Are you still in touch with that gang of boys that you hung around with?
I am. I am in touch with them. Not all of them. Not the kid who took me into the woods, by the way.
I don't quite want to know where that kid is at.
He hasn't turned out that bad. But he did other bad things back then. I won't talk about here. But one family in particular, they lived across the street from us. They lived on the other side of this patch of street where we played all the time. Four boys and one girl. And they had a really lively house. I kind of admired their household. They had so much fun. And I'm still in good touch with them and see them quite a bit.
Yeah. So what do you think Mike, the biggest obstacle is for kids now having the sort of childhood that you've just described so vividly.
It's interesting. I very much I'm in favor of free markets and capitalism and choice, but sometimes I think kids have too much choice today. They have too many things competing for their time. There's so many video games, very attractive video games, seemingly very enticing video games. They have lots of television stations, hundreds of television stations. They have the internet and all the things you can search in the internet, and you have Facebook. And all those things, if they're all competing for kids' attention, then the neighborhood may not seem as interesting to them. So I think that sometimes I think maybe if parents, I wouldn't say cut off television, cut off video games completely, but if they limited them, it would be a fairer fight. And a lot of what I advocate, one of the things I advocate in Playborhood is cutting out some of those alternatives to some extent, but also making the neighborhood more interesting, making it a place where kids really want to be. And it won by default, especially when my father was a kid or when I was a kid. But now the neighborhood doesn't win very often because these video games are so attractive. So what we've done in our house, in our neighborhood, and what a lot of other places I've written about have done, is just kind of pump up the neighborhood, make it a really cool place that kids want to be.
So before we get to that discussion, you know, about how you've actually made those changes in your house and in your wider neighborhood, I wonder what criteria you and your wife went into parenting with about what a good parent is. I mean, is that something you've reflected on with each other before you had kids, what you wanted?
Absolutely, I've reflected on it. But first, though, I hate to say this, because it sounds like we hadn't thought a lot about how being a great parent. But the first step was to we looked at the way kids were being raised today, and we said, we don't want to do this.
What in particular didn't you want?
We didn't want our kids to not have a life outside their homes in their neighborhoods. And I think the neighborhood is very important. That's where my best memories are. I think it's a magical place. It's the place where kids have the best experiences. And if you ask most people my generation or older, what are your best memories of childhood, most of them are in their neighborhood with no adults around. And to raise my kid without those experiences, without that possibility, just broke my heart. Now, once we get that out of the way, you know, that we want them to be outside in the neighborhood, sure, we want them to be courteous, and we want them to have good moral sense. We want them to know how to have fun, treat people well, all those sorts of things. But it starts, you know, with something that kids don't have today.
Mm. Did your wife have a similarly free-range neighborhood experience as a kid?
My wife is from China, and she had one experience when she was in China, and then when she was seven and she left to move to Canada, she had a different experience. In China, she lived in a neighborhood teeming with people, lots of relatives, and she was able to just run out and go to different homes without thinking about it. There wasn't a lot of space, but she was very free and a lot of loving people right around her. She moved to Canada, and she and her parents were immigrants, and they hopped around from place to place, moving up to better places to live. And it was more restricted. But I think I know that she always idealized the time that she had in China, having so many people close to her all around and not feeling like she was limited to one place.
So you weren't having to convince her this is the kind of childhood that
right,
we should offer our
right.
kids.
So we had different, very different childhoods in a lot of ways, but she absolutely believes, like I do, that kids need to be able to make more of their own decisions and get outside their house and be more free.
There's been a pressure, I think, or a change in the pressure that parents put on themselves in terms of parenting. I mean, it's a bit of a paradox that I think parents are trying harder than they have before, but it may be trying hard in the wrong ways. That effort may be part of the problem.
Yeah, I think that one thing that people may fear in being the kind of parent that I've tried to be, my wife and I have tried to be with our kids, is they may feel like, oh, we're not as loving to our kids because these other parents are taking their kids to all these different events and you know, really planning their kids' lives more than we do. What I like to say is, you know, I'm very, very involved in my kids' lives. My wife is as well. We like to kind of set the groundwork for their lives and not control their everyday movements. So we spend a lot of time making our yard into a great place for them and friends to come. I run a neighborhood summer camp 1 week every summer when we have kids from the neighborhood come every morning for 1 week and play. But our whole emphasis, and we take our kids out in the front yard to play, but we're very happy to sit back and let them, you know, let them go a little bit. We don't need to be in control. We're happy that we created a great environment for them. I think a lot of parents equate love or their feeling of caring for their kids with controlling, and we don't think that's good for our kids.
So, Mike, we've heard about your childhood and the outdoor free roaming that you did as a kid, really from a very young age, from four or so. And I think that a lot of us can relate with that, relate to that when we think about our own childhoods. But a lot of us behave very differently as parents now. So I want to hear from you step by step how you and your wife went about changing things in your neighbourhood. How did you two choose the right neighbourhood for the Lanza family? What was your criteria?
It actually happens quite a bit. I don't know about Australia, but a lot of families find that once they look forward to their kids going to school, they feel like they want to go to a place that has better schools, where kids have more land to roam around. So we went looking in the area around Stanford University, which is kind of the northern edge of Silicon Valley. And I figured I would just find a home in a great neighborhood with kids playing, and problem would be solved. And I'm a pretty deliberate guy, and I'm not willing to accept what people tell me at face value, and I really wanted to make sure I got this one right. So I spent a lot of time looking at neighborhoods, and I was aghast. I couldn't find any place where kids were outside playing on a regular basis.
So I want to know about your visit to the real estate agent, Mike, because most of us go and they say, okay, we've got this house and it's got this number of bedrooms and, you know, it's got this number of car garages. What questions were you asking your real estate agent?
Well, I would say, you know, yes, this is how much money we want to spend, or we think we should spend, and this is the size of house, just like everybody else. But I also said our highest priority is to find a place where our kids can have a great life outside, where they can play in the neighborhood. And real estate agents, at least the ones I know in California, are very want to just please you and tell you anything you want to hear.
That's universal.
Yeah. and they say, oh, yes, we know great neighborhoods, and I'll show you great neighborhoods. And I'll just say their credibility kind of suffered in my mind pretty quickly. I came to realize that they would say anything to please me, and very often they didn't know what they were talking about. Real estate agents are very good at understanding what, you know, prices are and things about the house itself and how those relate to the price of the house and neighborhood generally. But in terms of what's right around the house, they just don't come to know that information, and they kind of slough over that. So that's what happened with us. I over a period of time, I came to realize that my real estate agents and any real estate agent really was useless. And so I came up with a method for looking for homes, and it was painful. It took 2.5 years. We ended up finding a house, though, in a neighborhood that has lots of kids. It's a very walkable neighborhood. Not many cars on the streets. It's been a wonderful, wonderful place for our kids. By the way, the house we bought is not our favorite house. It was probably, you know, it was not even in our top five, but the neighborhood was number one, and that made all the difference.
What was different about this neighborhood?
Well, number one, lots and lots of kids around our kids' ages. And at that time, we had two little boys.
And how did you discover this? What, just cruising by slowly on the streets? This is suspicious behavior.
I came up with a method. And so I would find houses online that might qualify in terms of bedrooms and bathrooms and price and maybe, you know, location generally. But then I would go there on, say, an afternoon, often a weekend afternoon, and I would look around. And I wouldn't go in that house. I would instead look at the whole neighborhood and look at the other homes and see if there were little things that kids play with outside the front of the front door. I would look to see if anybody was walking, and either I'd stop someone walking or knock on a door where I saw some kid play thing in front, and I would introduce myself and ask them a couple questions, they're interested in talking to me. I'm interested in buying that house in their neighborhood, and they wanted to get to know me too. And I asked if there are kids living here, what the life is like for kids. And 90% of the time, based on the information I got, I didn't even go into the house that I was interested in because I disqualified the neighborhood. That's the only way I could get that information. So I could search very efficiently online to find out bedrooms and baths and the look of the house and the price, but that's the only way I could get the information about the neighborhood was to actually talk to people. And it was a very time-consuming experience. I've thought of ways to make it easier for people. I'm actually a Silicon Valley entrepreneur and have started many companies, and I had an idea, I never started that company. Maybe someone wants to do that. In the meantime, I've spent a lot of time and came up with kind of a method for finding homes, and a lot of people have taken my advice.
So through your method of talking to, basically balling up to people on the street and asking them to talk about what it's like to be there and where their kids play and if they walk, you find yourself a house and the Lanza family move in. Was the neighborhood then straight away what you wanted for your kids?
No, it was not straight away what we wanted. I had the bones, as we say. It had the raw materials, but people there were living the life that most families live today, staying inside their homes, getting driven to activities. But I had a feeling that we could make, bring it out a little bit. So what we did is, every day after dinner, during the summer or even before dinner when I could come home early, when the sun went down early, we'd be out in the front. And I'd be out there with my kids, playing ball on the street, knocking on doors, walking to the creek, just being visible, being present. And I presumed, and I think I was right, that people would start to get the feeling who lived there that, hey, it's okay to be out in the street with these guys, and it's okay to knock on doors. I have an interesting story about knocking on a door. Our next-door neighbors had two kids right around my kids' ages, and I thought that was wonderful, and I got to know them pretty well, and it was friendly with them. At one point, a few weeks after we moved in, I went over and knocked on their door, and I saw their cars parked in the front, and I heard them talking inside. I knew they were home, but they did not answer the door.
They were hiding, going, is that guy who plays on the street? Yeah, he's here.
We gave up. So it happened another time, same thing. And then I saw the mom a few days later, and I said, hey, Adrian, did you know that I knocked on your door a couple times this week and no one answered? And she said, oh, it was you. She said, I never thought that someone we'd want to talk to would be at the door.
Wow.
She thought it was some solicitor trying to get money out of them or get a signature or something. And so, that was frustrating. But I think one thing we did, and it may seem pretty simple, is we sort of established a culture of knocking on doors in the neighborhood. And people were more apt to do that. Also, we leave our doors open. We leave our garage door open. We leave our front door open. We let people come in our yard. That's a, we'll talk a lot about that. Come
so
in our yard.
Do you have a fence at the front of your house?
We have no fence in front. We have a fence in the back. I grew up in a neighborhood in Pittsburgh we talked about where it was illegal to have fences between houses.
Illegal? Why?
Because the town planners thought that maybe it would break up the look of the neighborhood. It would make the neighborhood look like people didn't want to actually communicate or talk, see each other. That's probably true. But now fences seem to be the norm. I'm not enamored with fences. I don't like them at all. I accept them because it's kind of hard to get my neighbors to take down the fence between our houses. But we do a lot of things to entice, to draw people into our yard to play with our
kids.
So
what happens in your front yard then, the area that you don't have a fence in?
We have a lot of fun stuff. So I have, it's mostly me in this case. I won't say we. My wife has agreed to this, but it's been kind of my project. I've reconceived of every square foot or every square meter of our yard. to make it into a usable space where kids can play and have fun. If you look at most yards in the suburbs, they have lots of ornamental plants and things that look good, but don't really invite people to come and play there. And so we tore all sorts of things out, moved things around, and we've got, in a, what I think is not a very large space, we got tons of stuff that kids can play with and adults play with too. And
what sort of stuff?
Well, we have a basic thing. First, we have a picnic table in our front yard. Most people have picnic tables in their backyard. We have it in the front, and we have dinners out there in the front. And so when we eat in the evenings, we eat out front. People walk by, and they talk to us, and they share a glass of wine, and kids who are walking by play with our kids. It's kind of a little mini block party every time we have dinner out there. We have about 35 feet of whiteboard along one. So we have a fence between our yard and the next door neighbors on both sides. So we have 35 feet of whiteboard on one side, and we leave dry erase markers out so kids can draw and write things. We have a sandbox. Most people have a sandbox. Ours is in the front, right next to the sidewalk. We have a fountain. We have a play river. So it's a series of fiberglass cisterns where the water flows down and then it gets pumped back up to the top, and kids race corks and little boats. We have a lot of art in our front yard. We have two mosaics that we built in a couple of our summer camps. There's also our driveway. I go on and on here. Our driveway, when we moved in, had pavers. I don't know if that's a term you use here.
Yep.
We had pavers, and our real estate agent thought this was a great thing. This is very luxurious, and everybody wants pavers. Well, if you think about it, pavers are the absolute worst things for kids to have in a driveway. What do kids want to do in a driveway? They want to play with a bouncy ball. They want to roller skate. They want to play with scooters. They want to play basketball. They want to draw with sidewalk chalk. All these things are impossible with pavers. So I had the pavers pulled out, ripped out. I put smooth cement in our driveway. And then we had a mural painted. I actually designed it, and we had someone help me put it on our driveway. It's a map of our neighborhood. And I drew the lot lines on the streets for each lot on the street in the map. And the lot lines happen to be the size just right to put Lego base plates. So kids can play three-dimensionally, so they can run around on the streets, but also they can build houses in different lots on our driveway.
Does this cost a lot of money? I mean, there's a lot of stuff happening in your front yard. Did you and your wife have to put a lot of your budget into doing this?
To be honest, yes, this costs some money. Certainly it costs a fair amount of money. However, I like to put it this way. Inside our house, we haven't bought one piece of furniture and purchased one piece of art for our walls. Nothing. Our priority is the outside of our house. Like many people here in Australia, we live in a wonderful climate. It doesn't rain very often, especially between April and October of every year. It's pretty dry. So there's really no excuse to be inside, except that maybe we're trapped, except that maybe we don't want to go outside. So I want to make the outside of our house more attractive, more interesting than the inside. And I think we've done that. And I think also we live in a somewhat affluent neighborhood. I live in Silicon Valley. Lots of entrepreneurs like me live there. There's more attractive things that people have in the neighborhood inside the house. So it's kind of an arms race. We're battling against really cool Game Boys and PS, whatever it was, a PS4 now, Xboxes, all the great things that people have in their house. In lower income neighborhoods and middle class neighborhoods, they don't have as many great things to compete with outside, so you don't need as much there.
Yeah. What about as your kids have growing up, are they willing to engage with this stuff in the same way? Or as they get older, are they, less interested in the sandbox and the Lego?
Well, I have, initially when we installed the things in our yard, I thought about how it would, how kids would grow with the stuff. And I think we made some good decisions. One of them was we have a playhouse in our backyard. It's a really nice playhouse. It's got two stories and, we put in some fold-up cushions the kids can open up to sleep and do sleepovers on the second floor. And So my oldest son, Marco, has become kind of the king of sleepovers in the neighborhood. He's got the coolest place to do a sleepover. And kids, as they get older, they're less interested. Well, they're still interested in Lego, but they're more, their focus shifts to doing things with friends, kind of having secret spaces, places where they can hang out. And I think we've accommodated that to some extent.
You talked about how your parents pretty much left you and your friends to yourselves to sort out problems that inevitably arise when groups of kids play together. Is that the approach you're taking too?
Yes. I presume in Australia you use the term play dates. Lots of parents, it's the norm where we live, where parents will schedule these play dates with other parents, and then one parent is around and they kind of administer, almost oversee the play and how it's going and adjudicate whenever there were problems. My son Marco, our first kid, we tried to just let him go and have him go over to other kids' house or have kids come over without any supervision. We found that he actually has some social issues that we needed to address. But our goal was not to control his play. Our goal was to get him to the point where he can manage his own play. And sure enough, in a couple of years, by the time he was 6 or 7 years old, he was, we weren't worried he was going to do something stupid and hit a kid in the head or something and, cause big problems. He was getting better socially. And we got him to the point when he was 8 where I didn't schedule his play dates anymore. He would just figure out who he's going to play with after school and do that. Now at 10, he's at the point where not only does he talk to other kids about what they're going to do, but he actually goes there on his own. And so he essentially roams the neighborhood on his own every day without telling us exactly where he's going.
How do other parents respond, though, Mike? I mean, when your son asks another kid for a play date, are they at liberty to say yes or no to that?
There's a bit of a culture clash. There are some parents, and, most of these parents are good people. I think they're outside of the context of parenting, we have a lot in common. But I will, to some greater or lesser degree, try to get them to listen to, what we think should happen, what I think should happen, and that is that the kids should be working these things out themselves. There are a few particular stories. I can think of one neighbor. They're more protective of their son. Their son lives two blocks from us. Marco could go to his house on his own. This kid, Josh, never came to our house on his own. We had to call him, or Marco had to go and knock on his door. So slowly but surely, they relaxed. They now let Josh come over our house without on his own, just to walk over. I can't say that we've changed them. Maybe they would have let him do that anyway. I think we've had some impact on the culture in a lot of families in the neighborhood, and I'm happy for that. And I'm most happy with the fact that, the life that Marco has today, he has enough friends who are like him that he can go where he wants and they can come to our house, and there aren't parents hovering and checking on kids all the time.
I understand, Mike, how this is great for kids, but what about for parents? I mean, I don't know if I want my front yard open to a whole bunch of neighbors jumping in. I like my privacy too.
Well, I think for kids really don't need privacy. That's the first thing I would say. Maybe when they reach a certain age, they want to share secrets with each other, but for the most part, they like to be around other kids and they like to be around large numbers of them. When we redid our front yard, and especially, the whiteboard, I thought, we're going to get some vandalism. We're going to get some kids and grab dry erase pens and draw, ugly, disgusting things there or write bad words. And frankly, it hasn't happened at all. I've been very pleasantly surprised. People respect the space that we have. It might happen, but I think that people are a lot more respectful than we give them credit for. And I think people see, then our neighbors see, that we're putting a lot of time and effort into our yard. And That I think that makes them respect it more.
But what I mean, I think you're absolutely right that kids don't need privacy, but don't adults sometimes?
I'm a parent, I want what's best for my kids. I can still stay inside my house and do what I want to inside my house. And you know, if I'm inside and the kids are outside having a great time, I think that's a great balance.
Yeah.
Personally, the kids don't care what I'm doing. They want to play with each other.
Do you let your kids have mobile phones?
It's an interesting question. I am a big advocate of letting kids have mobile phones with limits, with very strong limits. But I think mobile phones can be a great thing because they, for a lot of families, mobile phones are kids' ticket to independence. Parents feel much more comfortable if they can reach their child and when their child's away. And sometimes something comes up and a kid needs to call their parent or call someone else on the phone. Also, mobile phones have mapping capabilities, so they can navigate the world very well with those with that capability. The problem, of course, with mobile phones is kids get so absorbed sometimes with mobile phones that they shut out the world around them, and I don't think that's good. You know, kids at the dinner table, they're supposed to be having a conversation at dinner, and instead they're chatting with their friends on their phones. So there need to be strong limits.
So like what are your limits for your kids using phones?
Well, I should say that my son Marco, who's 10, has an iPad but does not have a mobile phone now. His iPad kind of works as a mobile phone, but anyway, no mobile phone at dinner, no mobile phone when you're in bed, when you're trying to go to sleep. We'd like to, when he gets a phone, right now it's an iPad, so it's a little different. He doesn't have texting on his iPad. We'd like to say that you chuck your mobile phone at the door of your bedroom and you don't take it inside. There's a big problem with kids being woken up in the middle of the night by text and then feeling like they have to respond. I think that's a big problem. And another one that's important, I think, is no use of mobile phones when you're either a pedestrian or riding a bike or driving on a road. That's really basic. But outside of that, I'd like to give my kids the benefit of the doubt, tell them this is what we expect, and have them rise to the occasion. My wife and I have a somewhat of a disagreement about what age, but she agrees as well.
What, does she want older or younger than you?
She wants older than me. So Marco has an iPad. He does not have an iPhone. I have a feeling he'll get an iPhone pretty soon. There's nobody who has this totally figured out.
Yeah.
It is one of the most seductive, it's probably the most seductive single thing that kids have in their lives these days.
Well, the guidelines you give are great ones for adults using mobile phones as well, I think. I mean, it's not just kids who struggle with using this technology responsibly, it's adults too.
Yeah, and I would say to sort of at a higher level that, you know, I'm a technology guy, a Silicon Valley entrepreneur, but I think we have to make almost a religious commitment to the real world. We have to say that the real world is the most important thing in our lives, and so anything that detracts from our relations in the real world, you know, like chatting or texting, email, has to be put to the side.
Are there like-minded tech entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley?
Absolutely. It's funny. People think of Silicon Valley technology people as unabashed advocates of technology in all cases. There are many people like me who are from startups, from tech startups, and don't want their kids using technology that much. There's one kind of school that you may be familiar with called Waldorf schools. It's a type of education that has a lot of components. One of the components is that they don't want the families to have television for their children at home or video games for their children at home. And they're very strong about that. And I admire them for that. Well, the Silicon Valley Waldorf school, if you look at the list of parents, it reads like a who's who of Silicon Valley.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, employees of Apple and Google and Facebook and some famous people. These people get it.
What do they want their kids to get at that school?
I think they want them to be rooted in the real world. They want them to have real experience, physical experience, in playing at recess. They want them to read real books. They want them to have real interactions with each other. And they have the confidence, maybe because they understand technology well, that the kids will pick up technology and be very good at it at the right age. But 5, 6, 7, 10 years old is not the right age to be immersed in technology.
It's interesting because I think there's a wide acceptance now about the importance of nature in kids' lives. But what you're saying goes beyond that, Mike. It's not just nature. It's people. It's community. It's neighborhood.
Absolutely. And nature is very important. Let's face it, human beings have evolved for millennia without the internet, without television, without video games, and interacting in various ways with things in the real world, touching, feeling, walking, talking, looking, and this is the optimal way that humans can develop. And so without that, then they run into problems when they don't have those stimuli.
Well, Mike Lanza, thanks for talking to me in this old technology of radio and mobile to make your arguments for the importance of play.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.